is Lexi Vest.
And my pet is Alexander Hamilton, better known as Ham.
Want a treat? Come here, Ham.
When Lexi first brought Ham home, he was only 2 pounds, small enough to fit in the palm of her hand.
Now he's probably about 65 to 70 pounds.
Get a treat.
He is not chunky by any means. He's just really dense.
Well, physically dense, maybe, but smart.
Give me a sit. Good boy. Okay, now let's spin. Good spin.
Ham absolutely adores me, but I can also say that Ham is very much a one-woman pig.
Ham, come on, let's go outside.
Yeah.
Ooh, it's a windy day. Okay, here he goes. Here he goes. Are you going to run? Woohoo! I'm going to get you.
Actually, tomorrow's his birthday, and he's going to be turning 6 years old. So I think what we're going to do is just probably a day of his favorite treats, which are things like Cheerios, whipped cream, any sort of vegetable. The only food that we found that Ham hates is kale. He refuses to eat kale, but other than that, he's not met a food he doesn't like.
From Virginia Humanities, this is With Good Reason. I'm Sarah McConnell, and today on the show, all about the pets we love.
I'm gonna get you. It's his favorite thing. He's running around. Woohoo!
My first guest started as a veterinarian for 600-pound farm pigs. These days, she treats pet pigs, who are sometimes the miniature size of 150 pounds. Sherry Clark is a professor at Virginia Tech's Virginia Maryland College of Veterinary Medicine, and she says pigs make good pets, but for the right family. Sherry, you study pet pigs. What are these guys like, and are they a lot like dogs? Is having a pet pig like having a pet dog or cat?
They are similar to owning a dog, although I think many times they're smarter. But they definitely come with their own sort of nuances. You know, I mean, they can be house trained, they can do a variety of things, but they also have a spectacular nose and they know how to tear up carpets and linoleum. And there's just a variety of things that are a little bit different with owning a miniature pet pig as opposed to a dog.
And are we talking about those micro mini pigs that got so popular a few years back? Or these potbelly pigs? Or the giant farm kind?
So majority of them, and I group them as miniature pet pigs, and there's a variety of breeds of pet pigs. And so the Vietnamese potbelly pig is one of those breeds. They do range in sizes. So the Juliana mini pig is one that's adult size is probably in the 45, maybe to 65 pound range. And they're just, you know, really calm temperamented, really great with families. Not that the Vietnamese potbelly pig isn't, but their range can be up to, you know, 150 to 200 pounds, which a lot of people
didn't realize that.
Yeah. And a lot of people get deterred with that of bringing it into their home. They tend to start with them in their home and then move them to an indoor-outdoor type situation, you know, like some families do with an outdoor dog situation.
Do you think people, when they start out, think they can treat the pigs just like dogs with snouts?
Yeah, they learn quickly that the pig is a little bit of a different beast, but you can train them very well. They can be potty trained. They are very much responsive to reward training, just like dogs. It's just, I think sometimes I have determined during the 25 years plus that I've worked with them that sometimes I think the pig is smarter than I am. You know, at least I'm pretty sure that they train me as much as I try to condition them for, you know, what activities we're going to do together.
Talk about two things. One is how smart they are. I have always heard pigs are extremely intelligent. How have you interacted with a pig where you thought, this is incredibly smart?
One thing that I do recognize that I have worked with several pigs for, let's say, up to 5 or 6 years, they learn conditioned. This is what Dr. Clark does when we work together. So how I bring them into our facility or if I'm at their location, I try to do the same thing every time because they don't like change and honestly, neither do I. But some of the ones that I've brought in for numerous years, they know exactly where I'm going to take them. So even if I'm not really guiding them, like if I have a new student moving them, the pig just goes towards where I have taken them in the past. And they just toodaloo to say, this is where I'm supposed to go. If I need to go ahead and sedate them prior to a procedure, they know I do the same thing every time. So if I start to move a gate or, you know, bring a board in, they already are cued in that said, okay, this is going to happen. She's going to angle me this way. And then I actually have some that they know the injection's coming and they sort of, you know, brace for it and they get a quick little poke and then they know that part is over. So I know they remember. I know that they, you know, anticipate that they know exactly what is going to happen because of the same cues that I've given them each time I try to do the same thing.
So the other part of my question, what about the unconditional love, the non-judgment we feel from our dog pets? how do pigs rate on that?
I don't believe there's unconditional love with them. Most pigs that I know, like they do understand and respect their owners, but they also have trained their owners that the pig runs the household. And many people have told me that it's, you know, they love their owners, but they also, when they come back from an appointment with me, they may pout for 2 or 3 days and they put up with their owners, but they're mad at their owners too for a couple days. Like they will just pout and semi want to punish the owner a little bit. Like, why did you take me? They don't just have that like unconditional, like, okay, you took care of me. That was great. They tend to be a little more expressive in their distaste of something, but they do love their owners. You know, I definitely see that, but I don't think I quite see that total unconditional love that I have seen with dogs.
I love that you're studying the happiness of pigs as reported by their so-called pig parents. What are you finding makes for a well-cared-for pig emotionally as well as physically?
Yeah, and we're actually just now having a student analyze some of that data. So we're excited to see what our owner's perception is for the well-being of their pet pig. They know that their pigs respond well to human interaction, whether it just be talking with them, scratches, just laying on the couch and being couch potatoes with them. Like those are something that they definitely have attributed to the well-being of their pet pig. And I'm like, yeah, I can see that as well because they're very social animals. So I anticipate that when the remainder of the data gets analyzed, that we'll be surprised, but maybe not so surprised that that's going to probably be a higher rated factor than just food.
I imagine a good pig owner adapts quickly to what the pig wants and needs, in the sense that, you know, recognizes, oh, I thought this was going to be a dog, but now I get it.
Yes. And that's conversations that I probably have quite frequently with owners. You know, I got this little pig and I thought, okay, well, you know, we can pee pad train it like a puppy. That doesn't work very well. A more recent owner who was in showed me a video. It was a fantastic video. I'd never seen it. She actually had birds. She had rats. She had a variety of different other creatures in her environment. And when she got her young pig, they were trying to figure out how best to potty train. Well, they had these year-old rats. And they were really worried about how the pig was going to be with the rats. And oh no, they got along fantastically. And actually, she showed me a video where the rats seemed to have a communication with that pig, walked them into the area where they were supposed to start doing the litter box training. And the pig peed that day in that litter box because the rats walked them in there. It's like they understood this was a young pig and it needed to be trained. And they were directed him to say, this is where you need to go. And he followed their lead.
Like something out of Charlotte's Web, right?
Exactly. You know, and like I said, the pig teaches me something new every day, or the pig owner.
How popular are pet pigs, and has it grown in recent years?
Yeah, so it's pretty popular. When I got introduced to them, it was the late 80s, and it kind of fluctuates a little bit back and forth, and Hollywood sometimes helps out, you know, with Paris Hilton had a pet pig, Miley Cyrus had a pet pig, but I still think they kind of stay steady. And then I do get some really great, you know, owners who have really done their homework and know what they're getting into. But there's others that, you know, I ask in the beginning, do you realize they live 15 to 20 years? Oh, no, I didn't realize that. Oh, do you realize they could get to this size? Well, I had heard that, but we're hoping. You know, you just get a variety of those conversations. We're hoping they may not. You know, we've seen the parents. The parents are not that big. And then, you know, we still have a pig that, you know, they didn't feed them a lot. It just, they continued to grow. And at some point in time, we realize that we have a 200-pound pig. And after a while, then the owners are like, but, you know, I love this pig. I wouldn't have it any other way. And we may not get another pig in the future, but we are dedicated to the care of our current pig.
Sherry Clark is a professor of theriogenology at the Virginia Maryland College of Veterinary Medicine at Virginia Tech. If a pet pig is sounding like a bit too much work for you, Nancy G is here to sing the praises of the humble dog. Nancy G is director of the Center for Human-Animal Interaction at Virginia Commonwealth University. She's studying how therapeutic relationships between dogs and humans can have actual health benefits. Nancy, what is it specifically that makes the dog and human bond so strong and so special? I mean, for instance, is it a certain place in our brains that we've identified?
Our relationship with dogs has extended over tens of thousands of years. And through the process of domestication and selection for those animals that, for instance, wanted to hunt with us or felt safe in coming close to our fires and so on, dogs, through that process, have become adept at not only socializing with humans, but they've become very sensitive to our emotional states and our social gestures, like smiling and our hand movements and our body movements. They're able to communicate with us using very complex cues. They don't speak English, though they do understand some language. If you've ever asked your dog, do you want to go for a walk? They pretty much know what that means. But dogs are able to form complex attachment relationships with humans. And humans obviously do the same with their dogs.
What about your own history with dogs? Did you just back into the study of the dog and human bond? Or has this been something that has grown over years?
You know, that's a great question. I have been involved with dogs one way or another my whole life. I've never been alive and not had a dog. So my history with dogs goes a long way back. I've done a lot of therapy dog work. So I've had 7 therapy dogs now, and I have a 7-month-old puppy that I'm hoping someday will become a therapy dog, but right now he's a little more velociraptor than dog, so we've got to train through that. But, and you know, what got me into this whole field, quite honestly, was that I was training my dogs in agility, and we were doing really well, and somebody said, hey, we're going to do a therapy dog evaluation. I think your dogs would pass the test. You got to come over and just see. And I thought, what the heck? I'll give it a try. So I took my 2 dogs over, and they passed. So I went to this women's home for older adults, and the funniest thing happened. The dogs were super excited about going there. They pulled at the end of their leash as we were approaching the nursing home, and it, you know, these little old ladies would come out with their walkers and just come going as fast as they could to get to the dogs. It brought them so much joy. We were going every week at the same day and time, and the women really looked forward to it, and so did my dogs. And I started noticing things. And then I started going to a preschool that was at my university. And the teacher there said, hey, we want to incorporate you into the classroom. Would you bring your dog, you know, once a week at this time? And I said, sure. And, you know, the teacher started reporting, you know, this amazing thing is happening with this student and this is happening. And so it was all this anecdotal evidence. And I thought, you know, as a scientist, I thought, wow, I wonder if there's anything to this. And so I started doing research with this preschool population because I was seeing all these little anecdotes, all these little things. I was hearing from all these people about how beneficial this was. But, you know, the skeptic in me was saying, yeah, is it real? You know, if we put this to the test, is there really something there? Well, here I am. I have had something like 65 published papers on the topic. And yeah, I think there's something there.
What are you trying to get at right now? You have several studies in the works, but what is elusive for you that you want to prove?
I direct the Center for Human-Animal Interaction, and we have the Dogs on Call program. And back in May, we had 102 therapy dog teams. So that's a handler and their dog who come to visit throughout the VCU health system. And so what I want to know is it beneficial to loneliness, depression, and anxiety for people who are at their most vulnerable? They are hospitalized. In some cases, this is near the end of life. In other cases, you know, it's a long recovery. So we're looking at people who are in the hospital for a minimum of 5 days. So there's a serious reason that these folks are in the hospital. And our three populations are older adults, children, and those with mental illness. And what we're doing is we're randomly assigning them either to receive the human and the dog, or just the human handler, or treatment as usual. And we're looking at a variety of measures, including some physiological measures. We're looking at healthcare costs. We're looking at this longitudinally. So these three randomized clinical trials are sort of the gold standard of research in this area, and we're doing it in a major health system.
And what are you looking for?
I suspect, I think we'll find that when they receive the dog visit, they have reduced loneliness, reduced depression, and decreased anxiety. It's very possible that these dog visits will somehow alter their trajectory of change. In other words, I'm curious, does having the dog there, if it decreases these aspects of mental health or improves aspects of mental health, does it also alter adherence to treatment? Does it decrease their need for rehospitalization? And as a result, does it also reduce their healthcare costs? We're going to look at healthcare costs and readmissions as well in our 6-month follow-up.
Well, you're hoping for that because you want the cost of therapy dogs to be underwritten by the medical system?
You know what? The therapy dog handlers are volunteers. So it isn't about trying to get the costs underwritten. What it's really about is demonstrating to those other medical systems. We're lucky. VCU Health is very forward-thinking. The Center for Human-Animal Interaction is in its 21st year. This isn't new here. It's very well established. It's very well built into the structure of what happens at the hospital. But not all hospitals have programs like this. So if we can demonstrate very clearly the efficacy of these programs, then it's very likely that they can be established elsewhere and sort of more or less legitimized in other locations. Like I said, we're very lucky. The administration of VCU and VCU Health has been very forward-thinking. And it's also important, I think, to point out that the dogs not only are beneficial to patients, but we do see that they're beneficial to healthcare workers. And as you know, during this pandemic, it has been very challenging for healthcare workers. You know, compassion fatigue and burnout, those are very real concerns. And our Dogs on Call teams, when they visit throughout the hospital, we did a quality assurance study to look at who's actually touching our dogs. And 73% of the people who touch our dogs are healthcare workers. Now, they don't spend as much time with the dogs as our patients do, but they just stop and get a little 2, 3, maybe 5 minute interaction with a dog. We've got another study that actually demonstrates that a 5 minute interaction with a dog during the workday can reduce their cortisol levels to the same level as sitting alone in a quiet room for 20 minutes. So these dogs are making a very real difference, not just for the patients, but also for staff.
You know, I really appreciate that. I know several older people who I think would really benefit from the affectionate proximity to a dog. It's so hard to make it happen, right? Just to the whether somebody is lonely at home or in a nursing home or in a hospital setting, how do you match a dog with that person? The dog needs so much care, and the benefit to the older person might be great, but how do you pull it off, right?
You know, it is so important for older adults. And older adults may be in a position where their health may be failing and their social networks are decreasing as they age. And it may be harder for them to maintain their pets. But what we find is that pets can be so incredibly beneficial to older adults. So older adults who have pets, there's some research that indicates that they do have decreased loneliness, depression, blood pressure, stress. We also see that they have increased levels of physical activity. They're more likely to socialize. There's some evidence that indicates that they have improved mental functioning. There's some evidence that indicates they recover from a stroke more quickly. But as I mentioned, it can be challenging for older adults to maintain their pets. And so then we need to look at animal interactions. And this is where therapy dog visitation can come in. So recently, a colleague of mine and I conducted a systematic review of the literature, and we reviewed and evaluated the strength of evidence for 145 studies involving older adults. And the results show some interesting findings for older adults who interact with dogs. We see a number of decreases in measures of stress. So for instance, decreases in cardiopulmonary, neurohormone, and anxiety measures. Decreases in heart rate, muscle tension, and skin temperature, decreases in blood pressure. And there also one study showed a decreased risk of falls and hospitalization rates. Another study showed that when older adults interact with dogs, their physical activities increase, their walking distance and speed is increased, and their walking ability and stability is increased. So there are a number of really positive findings for older adults. The evidence is also there for adolescents, and the evidence is also there for children.
Would you recommend that hospitals everywhere and nursing homes everywhere attempt baby steps in this direction?
I do, but I think it needs to be done correctly. It's so important that that risk assessment be done. You know, where are the potentials for problems? Everything from, ooh, this door closes really fast. It could catch a dog's tail. To where the dogs might go potty. To who is and is not allowed to interact with what type of dogs. So you can't just say, hey, that's a nice dog. Let's bring that dog into the hospital. There's so many issues. You know, in the hospital, like it or not, things happen. Medications get dropped on the floor, and handlers need to be prepared to not let their dog gobble up a pill if it's sitting on the floor. So there's a lot of training involved, but when done correctly, I've seen these things. And I tell you, one of the first dogs I shadowed was a handler by the name of Pam Okenwright, and she had just an amazing dog. She went into the pediatric oncology department where children were having chemotherapy. And, you know, when you walk in, it's a brightly colored, wonderful space, but there's a heaviness to it because every child there is undergoing cancer treatment, and every parent, it's as if they've got a weight on their shoulders. And when the dog walks in and that child looks up, there's just that moment when it's normal, when it's not about this horrible disease. It's just about that child and that dog being a kid and a dog in that moment. And I have seen so many tears from parents and healthcare workers just watching that moment of, it's almost like you can take a breath. We're just taking a pause from all the worries just for this moment right now. And that's what I mean by those anecdotes. That is an anecdote, but it's powerful. It's moving, and it's very real when you're there and witnessing it.
So inspirational. Nancy G., thank you for sharing your insights on With Good Reason.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Nancy G. is a professor of psychology and director of the Center for Human-Animal Interaction at Virginia Commonwealth University. This is With Good Reason. We'll be right back. Welcome back to With Good Reason from Virginia Humanities. Cats rule the internet, and they have since pretty close to the beginning. How did the information highway become a bunch of pictures of cats? Dylan Wickower is a philosophy professor at Old Dominion University, and he gets a bit philosophical about cat memes and TikTok famous cats.
Well, I actually think the first one that I saw and the way that I ended up getting onto TikTok was a TikTok meme with Mr. Sandman and sort of waving your cat over your phone camera. And then there's a specific like dance that you make your cat do. You shake its arms and it's, I don't know. But most recently there's been it. Well, I mean, I can play it very easily.
Ooh, play it. Yeah.
Why? Okay. There we go. I need to turn the sound up on my phone. And so that sound, and then there are words that appear on screen, and the one that I have says, her name is Fatsma. It's one of my cat's names is Fatsma. And then the second part, the words correspond to, she wants pork ribs. And posted in the comments that, you know, no, Fatsma, it's haram. But, and that, I think that is far and away my most viewed TikTok right now with, 297,000 views?
No. And what are cats doing for us as we're sharing with people we're super intimate with, as well as work friends or student friends or colleagues or strangers even? Somehow, the cats have softened or facilitated communication between us, right?
Yeah, in lots of ways. One of them is the way that cats, they bridge public and private spaces in a way that we have to navigate quite a bit, and we've had to navigate more and more during the pandemic. As we've been telecommuting and doing more Zoom meetings and working from home more and so on. Cats, when they show up in social media, when they show up in online spaces, they show up in the context of their home, where they're at home, where they're comfortable. And so cats, they show up in this very strange in-between. They're introverted and they're at peace, and they're at home, and they're comfortable in a way that you never really get to see them unless they're your cats. So they project a kind of intimacy. They project a kind of like acceptance where the cat is at peace in a way that if you were with some friends or colleagues' cats, the cat would not be at peace. The cat would not be happy to just sit there and sort of snooze next to you. The cat would be wary. They project a kind of intimacy that's at this really interesting intersection of the introvert and the home office.
They also allow us individually to say something interesting or to give something interesting to the people we're sending the picture, the video, the meme out to that we're not allowed to say about ourselves so much. It lets us put ourselves out there in surrogate, right?
Right, yeah. And there's a universality about pets, especially pets that we're very familiar with. that lets us connect in this sort of way through them. Tim Berners-Lee, who's often called the inventor of the World Wide Web, he was asked what one of the major uses of it was that he didn't expect to see. And he said, kittens. He said, I never expected all these cats. And that gives us a sense of how strange this is, how prevalent it is, and how it's not just a matter of social media, but that cats have been part of internet culture throughout.
Why cats and not dogs or toddlers?
Cats are an ideal medium of communication. Cats, they have a lot of concerns that are very strong concerns. There's a lot of affective or emotional charge to the faces that they make and the actions of their body. But those directions are unpredictable. Like the, you know, the laser pointer and the rustling and the spirits from beyond that they see on our walls, of course. And so that can be redirected in whichever way we want to in order to communicate. And then with their bodies have a lot of affect, but in ways that we relate to but can't translate easily. So the movement of their ears and their tails. And then I think also really importantly, they don't have eyebrows.
Right.
That allows us to do a lot with their facial expressions because their facial expressions are very familiar, but underdetermined. So they can give us a look that, you know, is definitely a look, but then we can overlay all kinds of different meanings upon it. And depending on how we imagine the missing parts of their face, missing from a human perspective, we can fill that in any number of different ways.
There's a thing going around on TikTok now where women say men with cats are a green flag. Are dogs a green flag too?
Dogs, they put loyalty first. And this is, at least this is the analysis of the ancient Greeks, which of course I know you didn't specifically ask for. But as long as we're talking about TikTok, of course, ancient Greek philosophy is what comes up immediately to mind for everybody, I'm sure. So if you look, for example, at the Odyssey, Odysseus's dog, Argos, recognizes his master at this last moment before he dies. Nobody else recognizes Odysseus in disguise when he returns, but Argos does. And at that moment, his highest arete, his highest virtue, is this loyalty, this recognition, and he dies at that moment. And that's because that was the way that the Greeks thought of the dog and its nature. And we also see this in a really nice way in Plato's Republic, where Plato compares the guardians of the ideal city to dogs and says their nature is dog-like. And what he means by that is that they are loyal to their city. They put their city and its people first. And that's a virtue, but it's an incomplete virtue. Because if they happen to be guardians of a wicked city, then they're going to be on the wrong side. And in the same way, a dog, and this is the analogy Plato is trying to make, a dog is loyal to its master, whether its master deserves it or not, whether its master is kind to the dog or not, whether the master is a good person or not. Cats, you have to negotiate your relationship with cats, and you have to renegotiate your relationship with cats. They don't just decide, yes, I like you, or no, I don't, and then that's their decision. Cats as a species, they're herd animals like we are. They like hanging out with us. They recognize humans as the kind of animals that could be part of their group. But they're not just going to decide like, oh, well, you're okay. Or, you know, my master seems to like you. So therefore you're on the inside, you know, you're one of us. They're going to figure that out on their own, and they're going to decide if they want to have a relationship with you and what that relationship is like. And also, they might just not be into it at that moment. Just be like, yeah, no, I'm just going to go hang out right now on my own. It's whatever. So the green flag part of this, I think, is right on, that having a relationship with a cat, it requires that you respect boundaries. It requires that you work out that relationship in a respectful way. You can't force yourself on a cat. it will not be well received if you try.
Before I let you go, I know you have a new book out. Tell me about What Would Plato Think?
So the book that's coming out, it's a series of little blurbs about different views and ideas and positions from throughout the history of philosophy on different topics, like the nature of science and the nature of the self, and questions about God and the soul, what truth is, and so on. And each section, which they're very short, they're about a page each, is followed by a series of questions and some space to do some journaling in there. So the idea behind it is that reading philosophy, that's not going to make a big difference in your life. But doing philosophy and trying to see how it applies to how you think about things and how you want to live, that's going to be very useful and very helpful.
It's very appealing to me. I'll look for it. Dylan Witkower, thank you for talking with me on With Good Reason.
Great. Thanks so much.
Dylan Witkower is a professor of philosophy at Old Dominion University. His new book is What Would Plato Think? 200 plus philosophical questions that could change your life.